it was the first time I had ever heard that you could get a degree in winemaking. And I said, that's for me.
Robert Parker has established himself as a critical reviewer with an acute palate. I'm just wondering where that female is.
The wine industry is addicting. It draws you back.
To me, the romance is in the glass, and it's when you're done with the bottle.
And we would spend our summer afternoons swimming in the irrigation pond for 3 to 4 hours a day.
Even though it's tough work, nobody said it would ever be easy. You know, we do it as a family.
In the final analysis, somebody's going to pop the cork, and they're either going to like the wine or they're not going to like the wine.
Since I made Cabernet all my life at Beringer, I buy Cabernets, so should never let a winemaker own their own winery.
We were either going back to Switzerland to go to hotel school, or we were going to come to California. We had to get closer to the vineyard thing.
It's like when you go to one of those winemaker dinners where the winemaker doesn't quite get that not everyone is telling jokes about the acid level in the wine all night.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle and welcome to podcast number 88. This week, we feature Michael Scholes, winemaker for St. Supery Vineyards and Winery in Napa Valley.
Wineries of Napa Valley may be referred to as New World, but truly represent countries from all over the world. In Napa, you'll find men and women winemakers from France, Spain, Croatia, New Zealand, Italy, Mexico, and Australia, just to name a few. This month, we spoke with just such a winemaker, Michael Scholes of St. Supery Vineyards, located in St. Helena, the heart of Napa Valley. We met with Michael at the winery during the week of Premier Napa Valley.
We're all about making wine less intimidating, let people get a little less frightened by it. And that's why we want to talk to winemakers and show off what's going on behind the curtain for people to see that this is about farming. This is about, you know, the land and all that.
Absolutely.
So keeping that in mind.
So, but where are you from, Ray?
Me personally?
Yeah. I mean, where are you guys based?
I'm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah, that's where Life Between the Vines is. A very well-known wine drinking center of the universe.
Of course, important as it should be.
Yeah, where beer is, okay, beer is more important, but wine is growing.
Right.
And they say it takes a lot of good beer to make great wine, right?
Yep, absolutely.
So, I'm here with Michael Scholes at St. Supery Winery here in Napa Valley. How are you doing, Michael?
Excellent, thank you. Fantastic.
Thanks for taking the time. I know that you're real busy today, so we will try and keep this as painless as we can.
Yeah, no, this is terrific. I have no problem.
Great. Now, I'm going to take a guess here, and I seem to remember you're from New Zealand. Am I correct?
No, Australia. That's all right.
For some odd reason, I had it in my head, because I remember I did talk to another winemaker who was from New Zealand.
Yeah, you know, I was just on the phone to Bill Nancaro.
I know Bill.
He happens to be from New Zealand.
Right.
So,
that's,
you know, we all sound a bit the same.
What part of Australia are you from?
You know, I grew up in the Barossa Valley in South Australia, which of course is one of the very old districts of Australia, or wine growing districts, and I guess probably today the most recognised wine district. And I grew up on an old vineyard, so I was pretty fortunate with that. And what I was doing down there, to be quite frank, on weekends, if I needed pocket money, my job was to go out and prune vines or dig holes and plant vines and put posts in and do various things like that. So I grew up on a vineyard in the Barossa Valley in Australia.
So you didn't have a paper route, you had a vineyard.
That's correct. That's exactly right. Yeah.
So it's fair to say it's in your blood then.
A little bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Obviously you picked up these jobs when you're younger. Did you immediately, you know, did you work through the idea of being a laborer in a winery, or did you do other things before you've become this winemaker that you are?
Well, look, my dad was a grape grower. And that's what he did. And he didn't make wine. He just grew grapes and he supplied to other winemakers. And I grew up on the vineyard. So whatever goes along with growing grapes, I was involved with in some fashion or other. And obviously, as the older I became, as I grew up on that vineyard, you know, the more I was involved in and therefore was fortunate to get a little understanding about viticulture, just on a practical sense. And that's sort of what I was doing growing up, and that's what I was involved in. So it wasn't more going searching out for it was doing that. But later on, finishing high school and deciding to go into winemaking, what have you, that I had the opportunity to go in and sort of extend that part of the career. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go back to your dad for a minute. He grew the grapes, but never made his own wine ever. I mean, did he ever fool around or just kind of experiment, or just simply he was the farmer?
Well, it's a longer story than that, where I grew up. I mean, I've lived here in California for a long time now, but he was a grape grower, but a grape grower on a family property. And just like I grew up in the place, he grew up on it too. So I'm actually sixth generation on that property. My dad was fifth, and in actual fact, the place was settled by my great-great-great-grandfather. Mm-hmm. And they were the initial settlers. So that property actually never changed hands, and we hold the original title to that land. We're the first settlers at my family. So when they got there, when they arrived originally in 1845, they arrived to be farmers. They weren't necessarily arriving to be grape growers and what have you, but as time came along, they did mixed farming of various types and then became involved in viticulture because that's what was happening in the Barossa in the early 1900s. And we still have vineyards now growing in that place, which is pretty cool, pretty old, gnarly, sort of twisted vines, which is excellent. But my dad continued that sort of approach. He happened to be a doctor as well, and so he was a doctor and running the family property, and that's what he did. My brother and I came along. Well, he didn't make wine. We did decide to make wine. So it turned.
Did your dad know you were making this wine?
Initially? He knew that his cellar was dwindling. That's right. Had to be replenished and restocked.
Nothing spoken.
Exactly. But no, listen, it was a great place. And it was good. And, you know, I was very fortunate that I had the opportunity to grow up in such a situation. It was fantastic. You know.
And for our listeners, I know where Barossa Valley is, but just describe it in the country, in Australia, exactly where they would see it.
Well, if you haven't been to Australia, envision a picture of it. If you drew a line right through the middle from the top to the bottom where it dissects the south coast, is about where Adelaide is. And Adelaide is the capital of South Australia, and the Barossa Valley is right near that, right near the south coast. So we're a bit, much like Napa Valley is coastal, mm-hmm. we are as well. Where I grew up is about an hour from the main city. The main city was on the seaboard. Here in Napa, we're about an hour from San Francisco. Of course, you know where that is. It's on the seaboard as well. Similar situation. Mm.
So how long ago was it that you actually became a winemaker, a bona fide winemaker, as opposed to sneaking behind your dad's back?
Well, listen, you know, I went and studied winemaking out of high school. So that's been a while ago now. And I started making wine in Australia. And, of course, my brother happens to be a winemaker too. So we've sort of been involved in this whole business in some fashion or another forever. I was down there making wine there, and then I travelled around the world, and then I ended up landing in California, and hence I'm here in Napa Valley today at St. Supery. But yeah, I don't know, I've been making wine for 25 years, something like that. Yeah, I hate to tell you how old I am, but that's the way, that's the reality of it.
You know, I'll be honest, I really couldn't guess. I'm not good at that anyway, but you do strike me as being youthful, I'll give you that.
That's very kind.
Okay. Good, I won him over on that one.
Yeah, right.
Is your brother in the States or is he back in Australia?
No, he's in Australia. He actually runs the home property today.
Oh, nice. Is your dad still with us then?
No. Okay. He passed on quite a while ago, actually, yeah. That's right, you know.
But still, to have that kind of a background and then to come to the States to do what you're doing, I mean, that makes you really quite an authority, doesn't it? It does come back to being in your blood.
I was fortunate to grow up in this fashion I am, and today it's been an advantage for me with the career I've chosen, and that's winemaking. And you know, I don't know whether I knew what I was doing along the way or whether I struck this by chance, but it worked out exceptionally well for me, and I love doing what I'm doing. Making wine and growing grapes is all I've known, and it's good fun. You know, it's really good fun. And here at St. Supery, it's brilliant. I mean, I'm doing the same things here that I grew up and being involved with on the home property, and that is we're in a state winery in the Napa Valley, and we grow, you know, a lot of acres of vineyard. We grow about 500 acres of vineyard, which Napa Valley Appellation vineyard, that's significant. We're not a very big winemaker compared to the big guys. In fact, we're sort of a small, medium sort of size outfit, but as a grape grower, we are significant, and we grow grapes, and we do the best we can to grow grapes that are going to produce phenomenal wine, and that's the goal. You know, at the end of the day, we're trying to make a phenomenal bottle of wine, but we are farmers.
Is everything you bottle estate then?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. In fact, everything that is St. Supery is an estate grown bottle of wine.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Let me just walk through what you have. Obviously, we did a tasting a little while ago. We had the Cabernet, which was actually a blend with the Malbec, and we had the Sauvignon Blanc. But what else are you making here?
Well, Saint-Supery is essentially a Bordeaux house. We have a couple of exceptions, but generally we're a Bordeaux house. On the white side of things, our main wine is our Sauvignon Blanc, and we have a Vineyard Select Sauvignon Blanc that is kind of unique, cool wine, but a small blend. But the regular estate Sauvignon Blanc is the largest aspect of our white production. We also do a Semillon Sauvignon Blanc blend, which is kind of, again, like that Bordeaux sort of focus. We're a bit different in the fact that, I guess, the Bordelais normally are Sauvignon Blanc dominant, where our blend is actually slightly Semillon dominant, which probably is, created by me, being from the Barossa, which is a place where there's a lot of Semillon. I grew up with that grape. But Semillon and Sauvignon Blanc, whichever way you dice it and slice it, is a great blend. So we do those blends. Then when it comes to reds, we are very Bordeaux focused. We are Cabernet dominant. We grow some pretty cool Merlot. We have some small blends, very tiny blends. Some that you can only get here at the winery of Malbec and Petit Verdot, Cabernet Franc. And then we have some wines that are a combination of those. So we are Bordeaux focused, Bordeaux blends and Cabernet focused, I guess.
Yeah. There's no longer any major debate about corks and caps, but it certainly is very embraced in Australia. And to the best of my knowledge, you do primarily corks here. Is that anything you have any curiosity or concern on?
Yeah, it's an interesting situation. I mean, it's a debate that's been going for quite a long time, and it will continue to do so. I think that here at Saint-Supery, we do put a cork in everything, but not all product is a natural cork. So, and that's where the debate stems, is the fact that natural cork, you can have inferior cork, and it's random and it's hard to eliminate, basically. We can improve the occurrence, but we can't eliminate it.
Yeah.
And that's the debate, I guess. But so what we do, we have certain products we put a cork in that is not natural cork, and that is mainly in our white wines. And the goal there is we want more of a even, consistent seal that doesn't allow much oxygen transfer, maybe a little but not a lot. Therefore, it keeps vibrance and freshness in the wine. And the wines we do that with is a Sauvignon Blanc and, mainly Sauvignon Blanc, I guess, is what we do it because we're making wines young and floral. We make a Moscato as well, we put in that wine. Captures the vibrance, captures the freshness and retains it for a long period of time. When you put it under those wines on the cork, it tends not to retain it quite as long in a vibrant and fresh sort of state. So we do it for that reason. Now, when it comes to closures, we can walk from there into Stelvin or screw cap closure and what have you. They're much of a muchness. It's a decision you make is what your preference is, what you use, I guess.
I just find it interesting when I've talked to Australian winemakers, there's no debate for them.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they use, end of conversation.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that it's interesting. In Australia, screw cap closures were used quite a while ago, probably before we embraced them here in the US. And a lot of the critics probably got on board with it early in the piece and therefore wrote a lot about it. And there's a lot of benefits to a screw cap closure. You do not have a cork taint. When you open a bottle of wine, you're not going to have that problem, so you do not have to worry about that. You have more of a perfect seal, so you don't have that traditional cellaring potential of red wines and so forth. So there's where the question mark, I guess, arises, or part of it. Those critics were very pro screw cap. The consumers in Australia got bought on board with it, and that's and ahead of our market here with this particular issue, and therefore became very acceptable by consumers. Consequently, winemakers got on board with it, and we as winemakers, it's really disappointing when you see a corked wine. It's very disappointing.
Can't even imagine.
Mm-hmm. And so when you put a screw cap on, you eliminate that issue. And so critics got on to it, consumers got on to it, winemakers embraced it, and it got to a point where some people actually expected it to be under a screw cap seal. So it's just a slightly different situation in Australia regarding acceptance of that closure. Of course it's accepted here, but maybe it's not as consistently accepted.
Right.
That being said, I think if you get a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, you'd expect it to be under screw cap, wouldn't you?
Exactly.
So,
I just find the difference interesting, and especially the opinions, because they're so strong.
Mm.
And even here, though, there are plenty of people that are pro screw cap, but still in a winery doing cork. As a winemaker, living here in Napa and doing what you do, do you have your own tasting groups at all? Is that something you do on the side?
Yeah, you know what? I do. We do. I mean, with other winemakers and what have you, we'll get together. Sometimes, depending on the what period of life you're in, you might have an organized group, or sometimes it's just an ad hoc get together with friends and what have you. But I've got a group of winemakers that I get together with for lunch, and part of that lunch is tasting wines. And occasionally we'll get together just to taste wines. Mm-hmm. So I do that, yes.
About how many people are in that group?
We have about half a dozen, but in actual fact, the total group is about... It's 10, I think, at the minute. 10, but, you know, you'll only have 5 or 6 turn up because...
Cycles around.
People are busy.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Life is busy.
So do you walk away with something from that? I mean, is that something you really feel that adds to who you are as a winemaker when you do these kind of tastings with other winemakers who share that information?
I think that as a winemaker, you have a vision and a perception of what you're going about to achieve. Mm-hmm. And that might be, on a particular wine, might be wine style and what that style should be. And so, for example, here at Super E, I had the good fortune back in the 90s of developing what our Sauvignon Blanc is today, mm-hmm. and what our Bordeaux white blend is, which we call Vertu, what that blend would be. And also things like the Dolhide Cabernet and the Bordeaux red blend, which is called Ilu. So I had a lot to do with those. Consequently, they're a vision of what I thought those wines should be. Mm-hmm. Well, when you go and sit down with other winemakers, they have a vision too. They have concepts and ideas. So when you sit down and chat with them, while they'll listen to mine, I also get to listen to theirs. It's sort of a little mind expanding. It questions your vision and what you're doing, and you get to say to yourself, hey, listen, this joker's got a pretty good idea. Hadn't thought about that. And therefore, it presses you to go beyond your spectrum of what your thought process is and what your vision is. And that's not a bad thing. You know, it's good to be challenged a little. And by the more people you talk to and sort of get opinions of, the more you push that. But that being said, I don't go to a tasting group and have this dramatic change in approach. That doesn't happen. But you do get concepts and ideas that it challenges you to go and explore. And that's positive.
Well, like I use the word explore. And you also have the root of who you are, what your palate is. But the fact that you remain open-minded goes to show that you're going to grow. You have no choice but to grow in this business, mm-hmm. though, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, this is not a static business. We tend to be, things move. I mean, technology moves, mm-hmm. which we're ever and always trying to improve quality. So we're trying to make great wines yesterday, and the wines we made yesterday, which you drink today, we're thrilled with, mm-hmm. and they're great wines. The wines at St. Supery, we've got a great portfolio right now. Yet, when I come into the next harvest, I'm looking to see what can we do to expand and enhance. So is there something more that we can do? And that's an ever-present issue, always trying to achieve that. So technology brings that, thought process brings that. Don't lose sight, which I try not to lose sight of tradition. You know, I had the good fortune of working with Michel Rolland for a long time. Mm-hmm. He's a terrific chap. And, you know, one of the things he sort of impressed upon me was continue to look forward, continue to look to progress and embrace change, but don't lose sight of tradition at the same time. And so there's a benefit to all of those.
That's a great philosophy, though, because you're looking forward and looking back at the same time. Let's talk about the 2012 growing season, one that has gotten extensive publicity, mm-hmm. and of course everybody's very excited about. How do you feel about it? How did you guys do with your estate grapes?
2012 was a very positive season, very much so. The whole season, you know, started out, we had a nice start to it, being quite a dry sort of winter when often those lead to nice red wine seasons. But along with that, we got enough rainfall later on to get groundwater reserves down so that we could maintain situations through summer. And the summer was warm, mm-hmm. but not extreme. We had a few hot spells, but nothing out of this world sort of thing, which is nice. So it's nice and even growing season. Maybe a little overall, a medium warm summer. Good growing season, great stuff. Allowed for great colour, great structure, great ripeness, physiological ripeness, flavour profile and what have you. So essentially, it was excellent. You know, really is the reality of it. From a winemaker's perspective, it didn't bring much in the way of curveballs, which is unusual. Mm. You know, you got to expect as a winemaker that Mother Nature will throw curveballs and they're going to come. 2012 didn't bring a whole lot, which, I mean, the biggest curveball was to expect, was waiting for it, and it didn't actually happen, which is great. It was just a very nice season.
The other shoe never dropped.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then again, it makes sense that that's what you're waiting for, because that's what Mother Nature does, doesn't she?
I'd like the next six seasons to be just like it.
Well, I can wish you nothing but the best on that. Michael, tell me, if our listeners would like to find out about you and about the winery online, how would they do that?
Oh, you go to www.saintsuperi.com. And so go and check out our website and look at it. We have a lot of information there. And, we're an estate winery here in the Napa Valley. St. Suprey is a really cool place. Mm-hmm. If you are coming to the valley, which we certainly hope everyone does at some time, come and visit us. We have a great location here. We welcome guests and visitors, and we've just rebuilt the whole place, and it's a brilliant location to come and check into. But more and above everything else, we've got some cool wines to taste.
That's what it's all about. How many cases do you do, by the way? I didn't ask that question.
We're probably doing about 90 to 100,000 cases of wine in entirety. That's all product across the way. So we're not small, but we're sort of a medium-sized company.
Sure.
Yeah.
But definitely a place worth visiting.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, thanks for taking the time out of your really busy day to come talk to us.
No problem. It's a pleasure. Indeed. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Learn more about St. Suprey Wines by visiting stsuprey.com.
Thanks for listening. Download archive podcasts from our website or iTunes. Like us on Facebook. Cheers.
Life Between the Vines was produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Original music by Tim Turton. Our intern is Steve Lance. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our web geek is Tim Panicucci. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2013.